Before we get to today's Defenders podcast, let's take a quick minute to thank our sponsors for this episode. True Car, big fans of True Car. I'm sure Jessica Jones, a fan of True Car as well, as we saw in this episode of the Defenders. When you're looking to buy a car, you want to make sure that you're getting real pricing on actual inventory. And unfortunately, a lot of times, that's just not the case. People configure cars online, only later to find out they're not available. With True Car, you get real pricing on actual inventory. This isn't pricing that's offered by True Car. It's pricing that's offered from an actual dealer, and not just any dealer, but a True Car certified dealer. It's a carefully curated network of dealers committed to transparency and offering you a competitive market price. Using True Car, you can easily find the car you want. Next, True Car is going to show you what other people in your area paid for the same car you're looking for. Now you know what a fair price is, so you can feel confident. Over 3 million cars have been sold to True Car users by the True Car Certified Dealer Network. There are over 13,000 True Car Certified Dealers nationwide. You'll work directly with a True Car Certified Dealer contact. True Car users are more likely to enjoy a faster buying process when they connect with True Car Certified Dealers. And True Car users save an average of over $3,000 off MSRP. So when you're ready to buy, visit True Car to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. Marvel's The Defenders, episodes 7 and 8 are over, but we're just getting started here talking about the final two episodes of the first season of The Defenders here on Post Show Recaps. Hello, everybody. I am Josh Wigler. I am joined here by a man who has always championed the idea that you should never eat fish in the jailhouse, Jim Gibbons. Jim, how are you doing?
Yeah, man, do not eat that fish, that jailhouse fish. Don't do it.
It's bad. It's bad. It's poisoned. It's going to hurt you. It's not good. It's filled with it's going to make you filled with the substance, but not the kind of substance that's going to allow you to live forever.
Yeah, jailhouse wine, top notch. Jailhouse fish, steer clear.
Jailhouse rock, also pretty cool.
Yeah. Do that dance. Sing that song.
It's pretty nice. All right, well, let's sing the song of the final recap of The Defenders here. Jim, it's over. We're done. We know everything now.
We know it all. And Josh, just when I'm sure you thought you were done podcasting about dragons, there's dragons all over Defenders.
I was going to say, undead dragons are really all the rage these days on television. Yeah, we've got some dragon action to get into here on this episode. We've got some, potentially some more death, some fake me out death as well. We have some, we've got some character combinations that are really fun to talk about here as well. Some great fight scenes. I think overall, just you and I were talking a little bit before we hopped on the air. It seems like you are higher on these final two episodes of The Defenders than you were on the most recent podcast that we recorded today.
Yeah,
although it'd be really difficult to be lower than where you were, I feel like.
Yeah, this show has been a real roller coaster where we started low and then we got high and then we went low again. And now, I think we've kind of middled out. I think episodes 3 and 4 definitely were my favorites of the seasons, but
agreed.
Of this season. But episodes 7 and 8 were good and fun, and they kind of introduced some great stuff, some stuff that was a little bit so-so. As this show has had a tendency to do, a little bit of stupid stuff. But overall, I think it finished on a pretty high note, and I think it did what these series do very well, which is, I'm not sure they ever end super well, but they always have me very, very curious. Their endings always leave me very curious as to what's going to happen next. And that is very much where we left the show as far as, me as a viewer.
Yeah, no, I think that they leave most of the characters in some pretty interesting positions that definitely set the stage for where they might be going in their second seasons or their third season in the case of Daredevil, even if for a hot minute there they're trying to make you think there won't even be a Daredevil season 3. But come on. Also, by the way, they had announced Daredevil season 3 beforehand, so it's like that's really kind of taking the fangs out of the fing fang foom on this one.
Yeah, I mean, we I'm sure we'll jump to the ending at some point, but that really bummed me out. I thought it would have been great to have no reveal that Daredevil is probably still alive and kicking somewhere. I thought it would have been very cool and very ballsy to just leave it as yeah, he's probably dead, and what's Daredevil season 3 going to be? Well, who knows? Tune in. But that is not the route they went, unfortunately, I think. Killed a little of the suspense.
Just a touch, but we'll have some. I mean, even if he hadn't shown up at the end here, we would all be like, come on, they're not done with Murdoch.
This is comics.
It's comics. Come on, stop that.
You know, and to quote the original, you know, one of Pharrell's early bands, Nerd, no one ever really dies.
Wow, I don't know that one. I'll have to completely take your word for that. This could be just like a long con, but I'm gonna be happy and say that that is a thing that is real.
File that under bad references to work.
No, I love it. All right, so we're gonna talk through these final two episodes of The Defenders. This is not gonna be our final podcast. We are going to do a feedback show as well. Make sure you get your feedback sent to us over the next few days. postshowrecaps.com/feedback. Is our feedback form. You can also tweet at Jim and I. He is at the Jim Gibbons. I am at Round Howard. We will be taking your feedback on a show that we're going to try and record over this coming Labor Day weekend, maybe a couple of days after that. We'll figure out the exact timing off the air, but look out for that feedback show coming up in a little bit, and we'll get into some predictions for where the Marvel Netflix universe is going to go after The Defenders, although I'm sure we'll get into some of that here today as well. Let's dive into it. Where do you want to start, Jim? Like, what's like the major headline from these two final episodes for you?
It's tough to say. I mean, when I look at this whole series now, having gone through the whole thing, what I come away with is a few different things, right? And we can talk about all these different things in their own given time. But I think the hand seems to have been really botched in this show, which is unfortunate because I think you bring all your heroes together and they never really felt like they had that much of a formidable villain. Though I will say in these last two episodes, Elodie Young as Elektra, it's like, why did they have Elektra just napping for six episodes? She's so good in these last two episodes. It's a real shame. But I would say
In fairness, it was just one nap, Jim. You know, like there was only one actual nap. And it was like for like a half minute, you know?
One actual nap, but to have... You know, she is really engaging on screen, especially in her role as the villainous Elektra. And it's a shame that for six episodes, she's just kind of playing dumb and not talking and just hanging out. But I would say the thing that the biggest headline for me in this show that I think is kind of makes sense and is weird at the same time, and it all ties together, is this show was driven by the hand in a lot of ways. Which is a questionable decision, but it makes the whole show very much more about Iron Fist and Daredevil. And I think the stuff they pushed forward on Iron Fist, it felt very much like an epilogue to Iron Fist Season 1, and it felt very much like a prologue to Daredevil Season 3.
Yeah, and so you're saying maybe a little bit of a jip for Luke Cage and Jessica?
Yeah, I think their characters have some great moments. I think they engage, you know, all of the Luke Danny stuff is really good. The Jessica Matt stuff, which I don't think either of us necessarily saw coming, but their dynamic together is really very cool. But I did not feel like their characters got the same push forward on a character level that Danny and Matt did, which it feels like this season really, really informed who Danny Rand is in the Marvel Netflix universe and who Matt Murdock is. But with Luke and Jessica, they felt a little bit more like the supporting cast of the Defenders, even though screen time-wise, they're absolutely stars of the show.
I think for Luke especially, I feel that way. Like, I do feel like Luke is, like, he's kind of old reliable, right? Like, mm-hmm. He's literally just, like, such a sturdy guy. But I think that he's a really sturdy character as well. And he doesn't, to me, go through a ton of change. Like, it's his big moment at the top of the finale where he's like, I can't believe I'm about to say this, but let's do something crazy. And he delivers it exactly like that, by the way. Like, you know, is that like his big arc? Otherwise, I don't really know what his arc is. Is it forgiving Jessica? Is it like the two of them completely healing their rift? So that's a little bit unclear for me in terms of what you're walking away from the Defenders gaining with Luke Cage. You're just yada-yadaing through the prison stuff that never really happened. He's back in Harlem by the end of this thing, so season two is not going to have to spend any time in jail. Speaking of the Jailhouse Rock, I think for Jessica, I feel more closure. I think for Jessica, I feel a little bit more of a sense of something was accomplished here with the character, where you're leaving the first season of Jessica Jones, which is a very powerful season as it's talking about, you know, violation of the body, violation of the mind, and like fighting your harassers and fighting the, you know, the inner and external demons in your life. And it's a very traumatic thing that she has gone through throughout that first season of Jessica Jones, and even in the you know, the story that predates the season. And it ends in this very dramatic way where she confronts that monster and kills it and crushes it. But you still have this sense of, like, there's going to be some work that needs to be done to, like, really get through what happened here. And I think that The Defenders serves Jessica Jones with a mission that is helpful in terms of getting her groove back. Like, I think that by the end of it, when she goes back to her office and when she goes back to her apartment and the window is all fixed and everything is going, and Malcolm is there and is, like, patching up the bullet holes and everything, it's like Jessica's like, all right, I don't know if I would say I'm whole again. I don't know that I've ever been whole to begin with, but I think I am whole-ish. Like, I feel like I am holier than I was leaving Jessica Jones season one. Like, I feel like we have a Jessica who is, like, primed and ready to kind of get back on the path that she's, you know, that she's been on before, and I think with both feet on the ground as soon as season two comes. So I feel like The Defenders push Jessica in the right way, certainly more than, like, any kind of tangible arc for Luke.
Well, and so here's the smart thing I think they did with this whole series is the whole Marvel Netflix universe, minus Danny Rand Iron Fist a little bit, since he's more destiny-driven or driven by this sense of duty to the Iron Fist, it's been about reluctant heroes. You know, Daredevil is less of a reluctant hero as he goes, but, you know, he does not necessarily want to become part of the Chaste. He does not want to fight, you know, his father, air quotes, father, sticks battles. He wants to do his own thing. But he doesn't really want to be the savior that Stick sees him as. And Luke definitely wants to help individual people. He does not want to be a superhero. There's Jessica is absolutely similar. She wants to help her clients. She wants to solve mysteries. She'll do good, but she's not out there to do good, you know, just for the sake of doing good. And you have, you know, there's a scene in this episode with Claire Temple, where they kind of lay out the same thing where she's talking to Colleen and she's like, my goal was to stay away from powered people. I didn't want to be part of this world. And Colleen is kind of like, look, you're there. You're part of this. And I think the smart thing they do here, and we'll just, you know, we'll jump ahead to the plot point is, you know, all of these characters believe, as well as the audience for a bit, believes Matt Murdock has died at the end of this season in a very emo make out slash fight scene with Elektra in a cave full of dragon bones.
But, where does this rank in the grand scheme of live action Matt and Elektra fight scenes? Is this better or worse than the Ben Affleck, Jennifer Garner stuff?
I think, obviously the number one best, Matt Murdock and Elektra scene is, Ben Affleck and Jennifer Garner flirting while they're jumping on those little seesaws in a park.
That's obviously first,
and this is probably second. So,
okay, fair enough.
but I think the smart thing they do, right, is that the heroic sacrifice of Matt Murdock becomes a rallying point to hopefully remove the reluctant hero trope from these six seasons of Marvel Netflix shows. Because what you leave with is Jessica and I think Luke both, this is the way their characters are most informed, I believe, is they both leave this Matt's sacrifice, Matt's death at the end of this, it tells them to be heroes. And they're, I think, going to go forward and be good guys now, not sort of, you know, the reluctant, maybe they will, maybe they won't, maybe if the right case comes along, they'll do the right thing type people. And I think that's what we get here. And I like that. I like that that is what happens here. But yeah, I'm not sure it's a very personal journey for them so much as it's personal in that Matt became a friend. He died, and they're going to honor his legacy, essentially.
All right, well, why don't we start talking through this chronologically-ish, at least. Let's talk about this one episode at a time, and let's start with episode 7, Fish in the Jailhouse, which is such a prestige TV name for an episode. Like, it's just like kind of like a garbage nonsense name for an episode. Every show in the peak TV era, Jim, like, has to come up with these very, like, esoteric names for episodes. Fish in the Jailhouse, what are we doing here? What is this? You know, why is that it? Why is it Fish in the Jailhouse? Because they're, like, new to prison?
They're not even locked up.
You know, yeah. So I don't know. I'm not a fan of that, but we don't have to harp on that for too long. It's just a kind of small irritant.
But Josh, remember, of the original comic book Defenders, Namor was there, and we were hoping Namor cameo. And if there was ever going to be an episode he would cameo in, it would be Fish in the Jailhouse, the Fish Man, the Prince of Atlantis. In the jailhouse, but alas, no Namor cameo.
Oh, that is such a bummer. I hadn't even considered that, but you are absolutely right. You lost Marvel Netflix. You blew it on this one. But what is kind of amazing is we enter these final two episodes of The Defenders, and Danny Rand is not part of The Defenders, basically. You know, like he's not part of the main crew. They have three of the four Defenders all hanging out together. They are the three that are most traditionally liked by people, I think. And then you've got Danny off on his own story. Was this good or bad for you?
I was going to say, if you hated Iron Fist, these were the episodes of Defenders for you. But I think overall, you know, we talked about earlier the idea that eventually these guys would have to defend something, and New York is a little bit, you know, obviously the bigger thing they're defending. But I do like a lot of the stuff they got into with Colleen Wing and Claire Temple talking about Danny and who Danny is. You have a lot of talk about the Iron Fist going on here without as much actual Iron Fist, which I thought worked well in these episodes, because you get this idea of they need to defend essentially their junior member, the snotty, whiny kid of the group needs the help of his older siblings. And I love when Colleen kind of likens the idea of Danny just really has been searching for his family and needs a family, and he's finally kind of found one with these guys, which also harkens to, there's a scene in episode 4 where Stick says to Matt Murdock, you know, he's like, I'm glad you found other people like you. And it's the sweetest thing that Stick ever says to him in any of these shows, where it's just a legitimate, like, I'm happy for you. I think this is a good thing. Now, given it comes with the baggage of Stick wanting to use them all to fight the Hand, but still, I like that there's this little bit of thread of family and what these characters can mean to each other. And so I think putting Danny apart from them and then having them meet up with them later and having them go to get Danny, I think it works well. It's kind of a good way to make Danny someone you care about, is by putting him in danger as opposed to just having him be kind of around and annoying.
Yeah, they turn him into the Daniel in distress.
Exactly. But I don't know. There's some good stuff here. I love that they're still kind of giving him such a hard time in this show. Like, even when Colleen is giving that heartfelt speech about, like, Danny finding family, you know, Claire's like, well, he's the Iron Fist. And she's like, and Colleen is like, I know, he'll explain that to everyone.
That was funny. That was great.
And then later, like, what is it? Jessica calls him like ironclad or some other, you know, thing, as an obvious, like, I'm just making fun of you joke. And he's like, no.
It's
Iron Fist. And she's like, I know. And that was the moment, like, that moment between Jessica and Danny really, I thought, was perfect in solidifying this idea of Danny needs family, because she rags on him like an older sister right there. And I thought it was really good. And I think, you know, Danny in and of himself, Finn Jones in this episode, in these episodes, I don't know that he is that stunning or impressive. I think he really peaked in episodes 3 and 4 of this series. And like I said, it makes me wonder if they film some of those scenes last, because he really seems to embody Danny better in those episodes than he does here. But, you know, he's fine. He's fine. I thought it was great that the whole plot of him, the Iron Fist being used as a key to unlock something, Elektra just baits him into a fight to get him to unlock it. He's like, I won't unlock it. And she's like, all right, well, you're dumb and I'll fight you.
Well, one of the things I really liked about taking Danny out of, like, the main action was that it led to a more prominent role for Colleen Wing, who was already on the upswing in that regard, I think, but also Claire and Misty. And the Defenders, like, kind of stealthily made room for Claire, Colleen, and Misty to be, like, key members of the Defenders. And I didn't think that I really saw that coming at all, even though, you know, these are, with the exception of Claire, unless you want to just, like, view her as her night nurse avatar, kind of, like, these are, you know, Colleen and Misty are both, like, you know, they're in the thick of the action in the comics quite often. But I just think that you, like, walked into this thing really only thinking about, like, the four title characters from the four previous Netflix shows would be the central characters. But one of the great surprises of the show in the last couple of episodes was the rising prominence for all three of these characters, of Misty and Colleen and Claire. I loved seeing them get a more of a central role as we wrapped up the Defenders.
Absolutely. And I think if what we maybe lack a little bit in a more character-driven journey through this season for Luke and Jessica, we got with Misty and Claire and Colleen. I think that's good. I think this universe is a little bit lacking. The Netflix universe is a little bit lacking in heroes, and it's a little bit lacking in lead characters. And, you know, we've chatted a little bit about this before, but Daredevil as a show really, really benefits from Foggy and Karen just acting the hell out of scenes that could be boring. You really care about the supporting cast of Daredevil's TV show, which you don't in some of these other TV shows. You've got one or two people you like. And so I love the idea of them building up more of a larger cast that hopefully you can have, you know, them play off of new potential heroes or villains coming up in future seasons.
All right, well, we'll talk about them as we get deeper into the show. So the first thing you see in episode 7, and it's kind of unexpected, at least for me, considering this man just died, but we start with a flashback. We start with a flashback that has Stick in it, so it's the final appearance of Scott Glenn on these shows, and it's a scene where he and Elektra are talking about what exactly? Like, what's exactly happening here, as far as you can tell, Jim?
I don't know. I can only imagine, though, that as Elektra pulled up, Stick was listening to his iPod, and he was just hearing Corey Hart's "I Wear My Sunglasses at Night."
Oh yeah, he always has his he's got his shades on. You know, it's a good look it's better than, you know, the no shades and no hand look. Like, I feel like sunglasses at night and two hands is a better look for Stick.
Yeah, I think honestly, I don't remember Stick wearing his shades at any point during the show, I think because we initially see him and he's a captive. And so I kind of forgot that was his look. And I was just more like, wait, sunglasses tonight? Oh, right, he's a blind guy. Okay, I get it, Jim. But anyway, yeah, I don't know what this scene is about. I've tried to solve it, and I just am not sure I quite get it.
I think that there's an element of, you know, we're reinforcing the idea of both Stick and Elektra's relationship with Matt, and kind of like this gravitational pull that all three of these people had towards each other. And I think that, you know, there's like the dramatic irony of cutting from that to cutting now to the present day, where these two people who did have some fondness for each other at some point in time just battled it out to the death, and only one of them walked away. And we cut immediately to, you know, the Nirvana music, which is fun because that was they used "Smells Like Teen Spirit" in one of the trailers for the Defenders, so it's nice to get some more Nirvana in the action here. And it's just like that playing over the shots of like all of these fallen bodies and Stick, like, just straight up dead, truly doesn't get that final moment except in flashback form, which at least they did give us that, right? Like, even if he's gonna die, and if you're not gonna be happy about the idea that he's just kind of getting yanked off the board without a moment, at least they gave him a moment at the top of this episode.
They did, and I think my biggest confusion with this is, you know, the time caption, which I honestly believe we talked about the other time caption. I think it's at the beginning of, was it episode 3?
I think so, yeah.
And that one, this one seemed like it was legitimately in a bigger font. We joked about this, and I think this one was actually in a bigger font. But it brings up what we talked about, I think, a lot in the last podcast, which is the timeline on some of this stuff. And so when it says some months ago, I'm like, I guess I presume that this is happening during Daredevil season 2, but on the first watch of it, I thought it maybe was post or like right before Elektra died in Daredevil season 2, and I was wondering if the reveal was going to come to this idea that the plan was actually for Elektra to get killed and become the Black Sky and infiltrate the Hand that way, which is convoluted, and I don't think that's what this ends up coming to. And I think really you're right. I think it ends up coming to the idea of we're informing Elektra and Matt's history with each other, which is the big finale of this show. But it did feel like they were hinting, they were speaking so in such vague terms in this opening episode. I kind of expected some bigger reveal or something to bring this together and wrap it up. But I think at the end of the day, it's really just to remind you how much Elektra cares about Matt, but that they don't necessarily think Matt will do what is necessary to defeat the Hand. And so maybe that's the thing they have to say with this. I don't know.
What do you think about the first scene we get to see since Alexandra's death, where Elektra is now at the helm of the Hand, and we've got Madame Gao, we've got Bakuto, we've got Murakami, all seeming like, this is like a really, really touchy subject right now. We have to treat this very, very delicately. Did you like this first scene with them?
I thought this is where Elodie Young's Elektra, I think, really started to come alive. And I loved her in this scene. But I think how much fun she is as a villain really underscored how freaking boring it's been to just see the four or five fingers of the Hand standing around talking about how they've done things. And so I thought... What I liked about the scene is it was basically saying, oh, you know how we've done the Hand for a while? Now we're changing it up with a villain who just kills people. And I was like, great. That seems like a step in the right direction, because the last two episodes were boring as heck.
Well, don't tell me that all we did was talk with the members of the Hand when it took two defenders to fight Madame Gao in this episode, Jim.
I thought that was great, actually. I thought it was really fun. First of all, I liked that at no point was someone like, I don't want to fight this old lady. And I really like that Matt's fighting Murakami and Bakuto while Luke and Jessica had to go head-to-head with Madame Gao. I thought that was really fun. It was unexpected in the fight scene. And can I just say this? Josh, I don't think we got any hallway fights in these last two episodes. A lot of close quarters fighting, but no hallway fights.
Where did we land? 6.5?
I think we just ended up with 6.5. I mean, you could go there's like an elevator, and like an elevator is small like a hallway. They end up in a cave later. But no, I think... And this is a parking garage that they fight in when the three defenders finally meet up with the three fingers of the Hand that are left. But yeah, it's a good scene. I don't know. I liked a lot of the fight. I'm glad they finally got pretty action-heavy in these episodes. And they do a good job of being clever with the action. Like, I liked... Or I think it was Luke, like, ripped a pipe out of the wall and then tosses it to Jessica, and she hits Madame Gao with it, and someone tries to hit Luke with a cinder block, and he just kind of crushes it. They do some really good stuff. I liked it.
I am still very upset that we didn't get hallway Hand quarters. That would have been great if that had been the big discovery at the bottom of the pit, just a headquarters made out of hallways. I loved that idea, and I will mourn it forever.
Yeah, a regular labyrinth of hallways, and they've just been fighting in every single one. An infinite number of hallway fight scenes. But alas.
So we're back to the police station for a good chunk of episode 7 of the penultimate episode. It feels like, you know, there are some good moments here, but it just feels really wheel spinny to me. Like every time that we're just kind of stuck here, and it's a reminder that, like, for a lot of the supporting cast, with the exception of Misty and Claire and Colleen, but, like, you know, Trish, this is disappointing to me because her whole arc in Jessica Jones season 2 is like building up towards her defending herself and being a good fighter. And Karen and Foggy are also on the sidelines as well. It's just a reminder to me that these characters were really just kind of completely underutilized. And having your three main defenders, not Iron Fist in the mix here, but having Matt and Luke and Jessica spending so much time in the precinct here in this episode with only, you know, 1.5 episodes to go at this point, just felt a little slow to me. I don't know how it felt for you.
No, I very much agree. It seemed like heading back to the police station just felt like a step back. And then you have scenes where, and I liked the fact that the heroes kind of try and level with the police because they trust Misty a little bit. Like Jessica gives her a little bit of information instead of just playing coy, and Luke eventually is like, this organization is called the Hand, and he just kind of gives it to him straight. But it was also, those were essentially repeats of the same scene where you have an interrogation and more or less the same bit of, a little bit of information being given, but not a lot. And so, yeah, I mean, aside from having a scene in which we introduce Matt Murdock as a contender for Luke Cage's crown of looking buff in T-shirt King, this did feel very, slow.
Are you saying that Charlie Cox, and Lord knows I love Charlie Cox, don't get me wrong, but he doesn't hold a candle to Mike Coulter in a T-shirt. Mike Coulter in a T-shirt is the king of the Land here. The indisputed champion.
I think at the end of the day, Mike Coulter comes away with it. But, you know, Matt Murdock, just not a character you see in T-shirts a lot in this show. He's always wearing suits or super suits. And there was this moment where I was like, I don't know where this universe, this Marvel Netflix universe lives, but they only have tiny T-shirts there. And, you know, it's just buff dudes in tiny T-shirts.
Why isn't anyone, like, more suspicious of Matt's involvement in this? Like, you know, Luke and Jessica are pretty quickly just, like, you know, in hot water here when they go to prison. But, like, no one's like, wait, maybe, like, hey, Matt, are you, like, Daredevil? Like, are you, like, secretly Daredevil?
I think this is, it's a thing they kind of joked about in the comics, but it does come up a lot where at the end of the day, his alter ego, you know, Matt Murdock is blind. And I think at the, you know, Danny Rand in episode 3 is like, wait a minute, or episode 4 or whatever it was, he's like, wait a minute, you're blind, but you're blind. Explain this, you're blind. And it is, I think it's, you know, it's as simple as that, even though I do like, I feel like Misty hints at just getting it. She doesn't quite say, I know you're Daredevil, but there's definitely this moment where I'm like, I think she knows what's up.
I hope so. You know, I hope that Misty knows in her heart of hearts who she's dealing with here. There's not really a major reaction from Matt about Stick, I didn't think. I mean, he does have that moment where I think he's with Foggy, right? Where he's talking about, oh my God, she killed Stick. And like, he's like kind of quietly upset about it. But were you bummed at all that he didn't really have a moment to really take in what had happened to the guy who, you know, practically raised him, really?
I wasn't. I think it made a lot of sense, honestly, for Matt's character. And this is the thing that a lot of these final two episodes left me feeling is we're setting stuff up for Daredevil season 3. And so it's one of those things where, yeah, there's only a moment where he mourns for Stick, but he's focused on Elektra. And then who knows what Elektra's status is at the end of the season. We know Matt is alive, even though they've had a building dropped on top of them. But Elektra, is she out there? Is she not? Who knows? And I think there was a lot of these moments where I just thought, all right, this is set up. This is things they're leaving to not be explored here, but they're gonna jump into those in Daredevil season 3.
Yeah, well, you know, Marco Ramirez is the showrunner of The Defenders, and he comes into the Marvel Netflix universe through Daredevil. He was a writer on the first season and on the second season. I think maybe he was even the showrunner of the second season of Daredevil. So it makes a lot of sense. That's the character that's the most firmly in the showrunner's wheelhouse, for sure. So it makes a lot of sense to me that there would be a lot of attention on Daredevil. And we'll talk about the final scene of the season, which really does, you know, it implies some things about where we would be going in a third season of Daredevil, which could be very, very cool. Did you like Foggy bringing the Daredevil costume to Matt? This feels like, you know, the avocado at law. He's such a good bro, Jim, but this is going to be something that he is going to deeply regret by the end of this show.
I did like it. I felt what really made it work for me, Foggy finally kind of giving in and knowing Matt is also Daredevil and accepting that a little bit as his life. And earlier, Matt has that brief moment with Karen where Karen's like, I thought you were getting your life back. You know, I thought you were getting away from this superheroing. And he just says, you know, Karen, this is my life. And I loved that. And I loved a lot of what this season did to inform Daredevil, which is he's Daredevil all the time. He's not Matt Murdock, and sometimes he's Daredevil. That's one guy. It's all the same thing. And I liked Foggy, you know, finally helping him out with that. But what I really liked is the last scene after Matt has died, or everyone believes he's died, where Foggy and Claire are talking about it, and Foggy has this huge amount of guilt about did he help Matt be who he was supposed to be? Did he end up killing Matt? And I think that's the type of stuff that makes Daredevil the you know, the best of these shows. Is Foggy has this great emotional scene at the end, and I care about Foggy going through this. And man, I don't know who on, you know, Jessica Jones or Luke Cage or Iron Fist I feel similarly about.
Yeah, not to that level, at the very least.
Yeah, certainly not. But, you know, I thought a lot of the stuff they set up here probably just could have been done a little bit more quickly. And honestly, it started to get really, really, you know, Daredevil-centric. There's a scene where Misty and Claire are talking about Luke, and it's a conversation that basically just establishes what we already know, which is Luke is a good guy. And so I don't know why we have scenes like that when we could have more people fighting around dragon bones.
Oh my God, so many dragon bones. It takes a minute to get them out of the police station, but once they do leave the police station and they need to figure out the quickest way to Midland Circle, and they decide that the fastest way would be just to take the subway, it's really kind of wonderful. It really is just kind of nice to see the three of the four defenders, at least, to see them just riding the subway of New York. That's my city, you know? Like, I loved that. I thought that was a great moment.
It's really, really good. And it's funny because that scene and a few of the scenes in this episode just really, really underscore how much the Defenders, if it was just Luke, Jessica, and Matt, would have been maybe just a little bit better than with Iron Fist in the mix. You know, like we talked about, Finn Jones came a long way. Iron Fist is in a lot better shape after the Defenders than he was after Iron Fist season one. But those three together are just good TV.
Iron Fist is in a lot of scenes with Elektra in this episode, where Elektra has brought Danny down to the bottom level of Midland Circle. There's the mystical door to which Danny is the key due to his possession of the immortal Iron Fist. But the key is really him just punching the shit out of this door.
Apparently, yeah. I guess that's,
I guess that's one way to be a key. Yeah. I'm confused on the mechanics of what's going on here with the door and the dragon and how it leads them to the stuff, Jim.
Yeah.
You know, what's
all that substance?
Like, there's behind this door, there is a dragon. Is that how it's working? Or are they being transported to another place that has a dead dragon somewhere? Like, were you following any of that?
Yeah. A lot of what happens here.
Because I was having a hard time just, like, exactly tracking, like, are we still in New York? Why is there a door that gives you access to being inside a dragon? Was the door, like, his, like, I don't know, like, his butt? And, like, now you're getting into the dragon through there? Like, how does this work?
Yeah, the first scene where Elektra rolls Danny down into this cave, and he sees something and he says, oh my God. And then it cuts. And I was like, oh man, what are they going to show us? And then when we cut back to the scene, and it's just a big ass rock with runes on it. And I was like, I don't know why Danny was so shocked by this. Maybe it means something to him. And then he quickly explains that he can't read what it says, so it doesn't mean anything to him.
Yeah.
And I was like, all right. Well, it seems pretty obvious that Elektra is just, like, going to play on Danny's naivete and get him to punch this thing, even though Danny has basically said, I will never do it. And then he gets goaded into just very easily punching this thing and destroying this door. He has opened the door that he has the key to. But yeah, and then when they pan out and we see that there's dragon bones all inside of it. I mean, initially I was like, are they inside, like, some sort of single creature? But it looked like there were multiple dragon skeletons. Am I misremembering this? To me, it looked like they kind of panned out and it was like just a hive of dragon bones. And the nearest I can figure it is that either when Shao Lao the Undying, the dragon that Iron Fist had to kill to get his powers, when he dies, his form goes to some underground burial place, which is either underneath New York for some indiscernible reason, or this opens a portal to wherever that dragon bone graveyard is.
Well, you know, maybe that would make some sense if there's some sort of portal action happening here, because, like, how else does Matt survive at the end of the season? You know, like, how do, like, we watch him get, like, absorbed in smoke and rubble, and maybe if there's some sort of, like, you can walk through here and now, like, you're in a completely different place, like, maybe that would make some sense. Maybe that would help explain if Elektra is alive at some point down the line, too.
I mean, the portal aspect, I think, has to be entirely guesswork, because nothing they really show us in Danny breaking through this wall leads you to believe anything other than there is some sort of secret dragon graveyard underneath New York.
Yeah, I don't understand it. Yeah, it's very confusing to me why that would be the case. You know, maybe something that's, like, deeply rooted in Marvel that I'm just not familiar with. But it was confusing to me. I would say, Jim, at this time, I'm feeling especially mournful over the loss of Sigourney Weaver from this show, when we could have had Alexandra in this scene confronting Iron Fist as she is trying to get him to unlock the door. Perfect gatekeeper and keymaster scenario, Jim.
Oh.
Like, that just would have been really, really wonderful. Just an opportunity that was left on the ground.
Yeah, they do a lot of talking about him being a key early on. Definitely a swing and a miss.
Choose the form of your destructor, and it is Finn Jones.
Yeah, missed opportunity. And, you know, Elektra was really big on just explaining shit during this show, and it would have been nice if she just explained what was going on in the scene, so that a whole bunch of dragon bones appearing after Danny destroys one rock would have made more sense.
I kind of liked, though, that Elektra was just like, yeah, we've just been, like, used forever. Let's just, like, break in here and, like, get the stuff and, like, be immortals and be awesome and, like, screw the hand. We can destroy the hand together. And, like, Danny's just, like, not down with that. I mean, I understand he has no reason to trust Elektra. Like, he doesn't have the history with Elektra that Matt does. None of these people do. Like, it's not an awful offer, basically. You know, like, you're here to, like, destroy the hand. I don't especially care about the hand. I kind of just want the stuff.
Yeah, I thought it was fun that they played Danny as a little bit, you know, the Luke Skywalker in this situation of, like, you don't know what you could have. Like, why not just give in? But I do also think it's funny that Elektra, you know, appeals to his sense of being used only to then just use him to get him to open the door.
Yeah, that was great. That was really, really funny. And it makes so much sense in the context of the Danny Rand of the Marvel Netflix universe that he would be gullible enough to, like, just, like, punch at the door. And that Elektra would be good enough to, like, angle him in that direction. But the fulfillment of the prophecy, Jim, the door is open, and behind the door, dragon hallways? Do we want to call these hallways? I mean, like, technically, like, if a dragon is lying down, like, you're in, like, the ribcage section, like, that's a dragon hallway.
Yeah, I mean, it was... And it was nice that so many of these dragons had conveniently, as they decomposed, I guess, just hollowed out hallways in their rib cages. There were tons of them. But
you know what? I gotta say, man, like, I'm thrilled that we have, like, dragons on a Marvel Netflix show. But, like, can't you give me one living dragon? Like, can't you give me, like, you know, can't we go deeper into the belly of this thing and can't we just, like, have something breathing some fire at you? I know that I'm so deep in Game of Thrones still right now, but that's, like, what we were talking about in these pre-shows. It would have been so great to just, like, get some turn towards, like, the real hard supernatural where, like, yeah, there's a turn towards the supernatural in the fact that we're dealing with immortal ninjas and, you know, a substance that can keep you alive, and you're now in, like, the dragon graveyard, so dragons are a thing, so Danny's not crazy when he tells Luke, I punched the heart of a dragon. But wouldn't it have just been great to just, like, have, like, a dragon, like an actual dragon? Would have been really, really nice.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I thought it was – I was thrilled. I really wanted to see these shows get a little bit more into the, you know, supernatural comic book nature of some of these heroes. And I thought it was great that we finally had legitimate dragons to a degree. But then it was – you know, then at the end of the day, it really came down to – you know, kind of just a street-level slugfest, which was still fun, but, you know, I was kind of waiting for, instead of just the substance to be behind this door, some sort of guardian of the substance, or I don't know, some sort of next-level villain or power or something that would have been, you know, added a little bit of flair to these final battles.
Mlair. I just had to say Mlair once because Kevin hasn't been here and it's been a while. All right, let's get into the final episode of The Defenders, unless there's anything from the penultimate one that you want to touch on before we go.
Can I ask you this? Based on this initial scene we see with Elektra and Stick, and then knowing how, you know, what we know that Elektra and Matt end up just kind of fighting each other in this romance abuse fight, till a building falls on them, what is Elektra's motive for getting the substance? I don't really... she just doesn't want to die, or she wants power. That part felt a little thin to me. I could not figure out her goal with that.
Thin Jones. I think that she wants to live forever. You know, I think that she's tasted immortality. I think she feels really alive right now. She's got so much power over the hand, and I don't think that she's really eager to be a part of the hand. And she talks about that, actually, which I thought was a really great line from her in that scene where she's confronting the three remaining fingers of the hand. And she's like, this isn't power. You're living underground. Like, you're taking, like, secret meetings in, like, these, like, underground bunkers. Like, it's just not... like, you should have a mansion. You should be out in the daylight. Like, the world should know what the hand is. The world should know about your power and influence if you really are powerful. And I think that she wants to live. I don't think that she wants to do these, you know, this, like, this shadow lifestyle. I think that she wants to be out in front, and I think she wants to be around forever. I think she wants the substance for herself.
Hmm. Is this all, Josh, does it all become metaphor? You know, I believe the show leads us to understand that the fossilized dragon bones are turned into the substance. So is Elektra the old guard too committed to continuing to use fossil fuels? Is this social commentary here?
Oh, my God. That would be an Inconvenient Truth 3. I was going to say 2, but Inconvenient Truth 2 already exists.
Al Gore pops up and he's like, there's an organization called The Hand, and they've been using fossilized dragon bones to keep themselves alive forever.
Blind Al Gore.
Yeah. Al Gore is a member of the Chaste. You never knew.
Oh my God, what a twist. All right, well, let's move into the finale where the Defenders begin the episode, which is called The Defenders, by the way, arguing whether or not they should blow up this building. And not everybody is on board. I understand, like, it's a very destructive act. It's a very dangerous act. But, like, to, like, spend, like, the cold open being like, man, should we do this? Should we not? Should we do this? Like, it's again, like, just a little bit slow. And it does build to that final line where Luke Cage is like, I can't believe we're going to do this, but let's do something crazy. It's just like, that's like your final line that we're going out on as we're going into the credits, which is like, okay.
Yeah.
All right. I guess we're going to do something nutty. We're going to go crazy.
It's like he's over there and he's like, well, I suppose it's episode 8 now, so let's get nuts, guys. yeah. But no.
You want to get nuts? Come on. Let's get nuts.
Yeah. And it did feel a little bit. I think we've had presumably, I mean, maybe this is just, you know, underscores the fact that it would have been nice if they had established the Hand as maybe a bit more evil in this show as opposed to kind of people who bicker over boardroom tables. But yeah, at this point, we should have 7 episodes at least, if not a few seasons of Daredevil and Iron Fist to establish that these guys are evil, immortal, supernatural ninja people that are doing bad stuff. Let's just drop a building on them. I don't think there should be a ton of argument here, especially when I think during this scene, Matt explains to them that he's used his power to say that there's no one else in the building.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, I mean, I guess that's reliable enough. That's really, God, that's great hearing. Like, if he could just, like, tell, like, every single story of that building that there's nobody in there, that's talent, Jim.
Yeah.
That's just, like, that's really, really good.
He's got skills, man. He's a lawyer. He's a superhero. He's a lover. He's a fighter. What else can't he do?
I guess that's fair. All right. So they all get on the same page. They all agree we're going to bring this thing down. We have the story kind of splitting at this point where, like, you've got, like, the Colleen and Claire contingent, and then you've got the 3 prime defenders. And the Claire and Colleen contingent will also eventually include Misty is going to get in the mix. And it's going to be like the 3 of them versus Bakuto for the remainder of their storyline. And there's no coming back from this one for Bakuto, I don't think.
I hope not. This scene more than any, like, what this scene did well, I agree with you. It brought together Colleen and Claire and Misty. And so this whole plot line of Bakuto stopping them from planting the explosives felt so much like we've literally already seen Bakuto in a serious fight with Colleen in which he dies. He's not killed by Colleen, but in which he dies. And this felt very much like playing out that again in the Defenders, which is a little bit confusing to me. But I like that it brought, you know, it brought these 3 together. It brought kind of, if you will, maybe our secondary defenders, maybe our new defenders, our new generation of defenders. And I love that it leads to a scene where Misty Knight, in the comics, she's got a bionic arm, and in this scene, she loses an arm.
That is like the classic Marvel Easter egg type of deal. It's like, all right, we're getting there. We're doing this. We're getting closer and closer to the characters that you know and love. Yeah, I think that it was going to be, you know, this was always a thing. Like, Misty is known for having the cybernetic arm. So cleaving that arm off at some point in time, it only made sense. So, yeah, that's exciting. I mean, we don't know what that's going to look like in the next season of Luke Cage or whatever, or how long it's going to take for her to get this arm. But it's just another thing that's going to push her closer and closer to being like an active hero at the same caliber as Luke or Jessica or Danny or Matt, like getting her in a place where she's got like her own like super strong thing. That's cool. That's fun. I'm really excited about that.
How worried were you for Claire when she had those swords to her neck? We really thought she was out of the woods, and all of a sudden she was about to get her head chopped off.
I honestly wasn't that worried. Like, I'd felt like you and I, in talking it through, like, I'd felt like a little bit talked down from the fact that she was really in danger. I think that there just wasn't enough of a personalized Claire story this season. Like, there were like some moments here in the finale where Colleen's like, you're a hero too. You don't get all the credit that you deserve, but you're great. That, like, maybe that could have been a little bit of setup for it. But I don't know. I felt like she was going to be okay about halfway through the series, I think, is really where it started to feel like. They just aren't doing enough to, like, lose Claire. Like, the utility of losing Claire would have been she had to die early, and everyone on the Defenders knew her, and that's why they would rally together, is because a mutual friend had died. Like, that had always been my concern, and that would have been, like, the Phil Coulson thing. But once we, you know, had everybody kind of bonded over their shared mission against the Hand, I think that the need to kill Claire, if you even want to say that, I don't think that that's necessarily the right word, but
like the plot device of killing Claire.
Yeah. The utility of killing Claire, I think, goes away. So I wasn't that worried for her. I didn't even think that Misty would lose her arm here, but of course, in retrospect, like, totally makes sense. And it's a great thing to have happen in the Defenders. Like, that's a great Marvel event to happen in your Marvel event series.
It was nice, especially because we kind of talk about how maybe Misty will get pushed forward to her more superhero position in this, you know, in the comics, in this Netflix universe, and we kind of talked about her and maybe Trish, who might become Hellcat at some point. It would be cool to see, you know, some of that get pushed forward. And, you know, we got one. Colleen gets established, Misty gets established, so maybe we get two of kind of the three likely future superheroes that are going to come out of the cast of this show.
Do you like that Matt has his moment with Luke and with Jessica, being like, isn't it great that we're all, like, really good friends now? And, like, somewhere deep inside the belly of a dead dragon, Danny sheds a single tear because he missed out on that really joyful moment.
I thought this is what I was talking about before. I love this idea of Stick saying to Matt earlier, like, I'm glad you finally found people like you. You know, I'm glad you finally found some friends. And I liked Matt in a way. And maybe this is a little bit of him mourning Stick. He's thinking about what Stick's, you know, kind of some of their last conversation. But it felt so sappy and out of character in a way, but was also just, like, pretty perfect. And it was just cute banter. I liked it. I thought it was fun.
How about the final fight here? You know, the Defenders are all down here in the cave. They're all at the very bottom of the pit here. First of all, there is a plan that Jessica isn't going to like. Was the plan literally just like, you're going to have to talk to these people for, like, a couple of minutes? Like, I know you're not going to enjoy that.
That plan... felt like, as well, in the writer's room, they were like, what's the plan? Do we have a plan? Is there a plan? What if we just have Jessica be salty and it's funny, and then they just jump off the elevator?
Yeah, I mean, there was, like, no, like, secret plan here, really.
Yeah, I was waiting for the plan to come in, but really it was more like... it was like a poorly planned surprise party where they're like, oh, the person's here already. Just you buy some time. You buy some time and then we'll jump out. But I thought it was fun. I mean, you know, it's like with I was a little bit throughout the series. They don't showcase Jessica's superpowers as much. And I think that is part of her character. She's not a superhero first. She's detective first. But they don't really remind you that often about her powers. And in a lot of the fight scenes, you know, a lot of the kind of head-to-head moments are, you know, Luke showcasing his strength and Matt and Danny going head-to-head with ninjas. And so I was a little bit, you know, like, are we going to get a little bit more Jessica superpower? And you realize, like, her attitude is kind of the main superpower she brings to the table, and she does it well.
Right.
I like that they executed this here. I also like that at the end of the episode, she's the one who basically used her super jumping and super strength to keep Luke and Danny from getting killed. And they finally gave her kind of a big traditional superhero moment, which flies in the face of everything she wants to be. But I like that she had to do it in this moment. So that was fun.
Yeah, I think the moments with Jessica Jones, especially in her own show, even where they, you know, they really didn't emphasize her powers as much as, like, you're getting, like you said, like with Iron Fist and with Matt and with Luke Cage. Like, there is the moment where, like, does she fly in one of the episodes of Jessica Jones, or does she just, like, jump really far? I don't fully remember, but I don't think that they ever did, like, a great job visually with Jessica's powers. Like, I never feel like that's a thing that they really, really fully cracked on the Marvel Netflix shows. But it's a great moment here where she is like, could you guys just climb up, please? Like, this is, I know it looks like it's effortless for me, but this is kind of heavy. Like, yeah. Can we just go? Can we just move?
I liked it a lot. And I liked, in a sense, you know, we've talked a lot about how Finn Jones really did in Iron Fist, especially. He did better in Defenders, but he's really done a poor job selling himself as a fighter. And that's because the Iron Fist is an immortal weapon. He is supposed to be one of the best, if not maybe the best, you know, kung fu master on the planet. And so, yeah, we have a higher expectation with him. With Jessica and with Kristen Ritter in this role, she's not the action scene powerhouse, but that's because Jessica is a damn good detective and kind of a failed superhero. So it makes sense. And so every time she has a moment, it's not one of those moments where you're like, why doesn't she look more like a superhero? It's kind of more enjoyable to see her sort of subtle superhero action, because her real showcase moments are her as, like, the snarky, salty detective.
So we get through this fight scene where I liked, like, kind of like the panorama shot. I thought was pretty neat, where, like, you're checking in on everybody in all the different corners of the fight. I'm sure you loved the Wu-Tang moment, Jim.
Yes! Josh!
Josh, my God!
There was... you know, anyone who's listened this far through these podcasts has heard a lot of critique, has heard a lot of salt, has heard a lot of just like
savory.
Yeah, a lot of savory, a lot of not, you know, I'm voicing some of the things that I didn't like because, you know, there was some good stuff. But man, nothing made me happier. Nothing really made me just like, you know, giddy, fanboy giddy than the Wu-Tang coming on during that final fight scene. I mean, after kind of joking in our recap or our pre-show podcast about how great would it be if Luke introduces Danny to the Wu-Tang Clan, because Danny has been, you know, he was a 10-year-old kid when he disappeared, and he has not been around to maybe have heard Wu-Tang. He has not had a lot of musical exposure. How cool would it be if that's like a way in which their friendship comes together? And yeah, that's not what happened here, but yeah, we got our Wu-Tang. I was so excited. I was so freaking excited. I thought it was great. Protect your neck, Josh. Protect your neck.
It was nice. I liked that. I thought that was really fun. And again, like that's something that we've talked about, is like this show has, I think, done a pretty decent job of like marrying all of the different identities of the other Marvel Netflix shows in this one cocktail. Like, you do have this great Luke Cage moment. You had that Jessica Jones musical cue that we talked about in our last podcast. Like that little, like those little notes, those little details when they're blending the Defenders together. I think that oftentimes, more often than not, I do think that they made it work. So everyone's fighting, and then the battle kind of turns in favor of the Defenders, and they're going to be able to blow up the building. So everyone's going to leave, except Matt still really wants to fix things with Elektra. And so he sends everybody out. There's the big, like, Lost in Translation moment where he whispers in Danny's ear and he stays behind. And he has this fight. He has this fight with Elektra, which you know, is not quite Garner Affleck levels, as we've discussed. But it's emotional still, and it's potentially the final Elektra scene that we'll ever get. Like, certainly we know that Matt Murdock's going to survive this thing. But I wouldn't be surprised necessarily if we never see Elektra again. Like, that could be it for the character.
It could be. I'll be very curious. You know, the whole, I feel like the Wu-Tang fight scene was in essence the big finale of the show. And I feel like, or at least it felt like that for me. I think all the stuff with Matt and Elektra, it was good. It was interesting. I mean, it put an end to their relationship. It put the whole thing together. They've had this kind of toxic relationship, is what was established in Daredevil season 2. You know, she's with the Chaste. He's, you know, kind of raised by the Chaste. She's a little bit more committed to Stick's plan. They love each other, but they're not good for each other. They're a toxic relationship. And it ended in the way that toxic relationships, you know, do. Someone gets hurt. And in this case, both of them got hurt, and maybe Elektra's dead. So I don't know. I felt like a lot of this, I had a hard time getting invested in it as a finale for this show, because it felt so much more like it was an intro to Daredevil season 3. And so it felt like a very emo fight scene, and I kind of giggled through it. And then I was like, all right, well, I guess we'll figure out what happened later. You know, I feel like the series already ended when we found out the building was coming down on the rest of the Hand. So,
yeah, speaking of which, that does feel like that's it for Murakami and Madame Gao. Like, I don't think that these two are coming back from that.
I hope not. I really hope that this building, Midland Circle, collapsing on the Hand and all of their dragon bones is the end of the Hand for these shows. I think, you know, what does it end up being? You know, Daredevil season 1, season 2, and Iron Fist. I don't think the Hand showed up in Jessica Jones or Luke Cage. We've got, and this will be our fourth. This is 4 seasons of build up to the end of the Hand. I hope we're done with the Hand.
You know what? I'm gonna disagree very slightly. The asterisk for me is I would be good with a return of the hand in like the Marvel movies. You know, bring the hand over to the cinematic universe. I don't know who's like the most appropriate character to build a film around where the hand could be a part of it, but use the hand where you have like a special effects budget, mm-hmm. and maybe that'll be fun. You know, like maybe that would work.
Yeah, and I could see as well if Elektra is still around, a version of the hand under Elektra's control could be a fresh take on it. But yeah, I think at this point,
can you imagine? Oh, wow, what if that's like where you see Elektra and the hand again? Is some sort of like a Black Widow movie, and it's like, you know, Black Widow versus Elektra? Like that could be really incredible. That could be really fun.
That would be fun, and I think that's a good way to think about it, right? I am not necessarily done with the hand. Ninjas as a concept are pretty fun. You know, immortal undead ninjas, that's pretty cool. But I think I'm done with them in these series. I'm done with them.
Yes,
in Marvel,
I agree.
Netflix.
I agree. I hope they're all wiped out. I hope they're all gone. I hope that it's done. I hope that whatever we're getting, you know, into next with Daredevil season 3, which we can talk about a little bit of speculation in a second here. Like, I just hope that I hope it's away from the ninja stuff. I think that it's run its course. And as you and I have both, I think, come to agree, like it did not live up to the billing. You know, I think that the hand was a little bit more toothless than both of us were expecting here.
Yeah, I felt the building, it was a little short-handed. No, that's not.
No, or long-armed in the case of Stick. So the hand is gone. The building is gone. It would appear that Matt and Elektra are both dead as well. You talked a little bit about your love for Foggy Nelson and Karen Page as supporting characters here. This moment where they are left to like bask in the wake of realizing their friend is very most likely dead, especially Eldon Hansen's reaction as Foggy, just like kind of like the sturdy, I'm not going to be the guy who just like hard breaks down in front of everybody right now because that's Karen right now, and I just kind of like have to like try and keep it together, but man, I'm not really keeping it together either. I just thought that performance was subtle and wonderful and great. Really, you know, that really does hit home. Like, you know that Matt's not going to actually be dead, but the emotional truth is there. And I think to have, like, everyone reunited back at the police precinct and everyone has come back from this mission and Matt's not there and mm-hmm. Foggy and Karen are left to, like, reel from that, I thought that was really, really beautifully done, actually.
I thought all of their post-climax scenes were really good. All the Foggy and Karen Page stuff after Matt's death was really good. And it's the main reason I think they should not have shown Matt lying battered and bruised in that convent. I really think they sell you on this loss. And you know they're going to do more Daredevil. You know, it's like you don't have to show me Daredevil in this show for me to understand that there's going to be a Daredevil season 3.
Yeah, you just know that that's coming anyway. But I mean, just to like kind of skip ahead to that, I guess at this point that's going to be the final image of the show is Matt in this bed, and they're, you know, he's slowly waking up, and they're saying that they gotta go get Maggie, I believe is the name of the woman that they're discussing. And this is apparently, I'm not a huge Daredevil comic book guy by any stretch of the imagination, but your friend and mine, Jim, the great Brett White, wrote a really great article on Decider, and a few other people picked up on this as well, that this is a scene that's straight out of Born Again, which is a really popular Daredevil comic book arc, and I think gives you a pretty good sense of where things could be going for the third season of Daredevil. I believe that arc is pretty Kingpin heavy.
Yeah, this is actually everybody's got their holes, and while I've read a lot of Frank Miller Daredevil, I've not read Born Again, and so this is a hole in my comic reading experience that I'm going to have to, you know, remedy when we're done with this podcast. But yeah, I did a quick little search, and it looks very Kingpin heavy. This is the arc where Karen Page maybe ends up getting killed, or she's at least going through some really rough stuff. So yeah, we'll see. I mean, I think going back to the Kingpin after all of this hand stuff would be nice. I mean, you know, I told you I would love to see Bullseye. I really love how capable Matt Murdock and how capable Daredevil is as a superhero. And I like that Bullseye, where they get Bullseye to be in the comics, becomes he is a little bit, you know, the Joker to Daredevil's Batman. He is just there to mess with Daredevil, and he matches him in skill. So I think it's a fun adversary, and I hope we see Daredevil.
It better be Colin Farrell. So help me God. So help me God.
Bullseye.
So help me God.
Bullseye.
Yeah, bullseye. Yeah.
I want a bloody costume.
More peanuts.
More peanuts, please.
Oh my God, that would have killed you on multiple levels. That move.
Yeah, I mean, Bullseye. He knows his target. You know, with that lady, he only needed her to choke on peanuts. With me, he would have just flung it right into my eye,
or just like rubbed it aggressively on your flesh.
Yeah.
That also could have worked.
One of his lesser impressive kills, but it would have still worked. So,
if we haven't emphasized this enough, guys, Jim is very allergic to peanuts.
Yeah.
One of the scariest moments of my life was when you ate almonds in front of me. Were they almonds? Is that right?
Maybe, yeah. Almonds, which I'm not allergic to at all. So.
Yeah. I was like, what are you doing? That's a nut. You're not supposed to eat it. You're like, relax, man. It's fine. These aren't the bad nuts. These are the good nuts. And then you ate a bunch of almonds. It's like, wow, you are about to explode in front of me. And you were fine. You survived.
I appreciate that. I don't think a lot of people would have thought twice about it, but I appreciate you're the type of friend, Josh, who you knew.
I was nervous. I was very nervous. So we have a sense of where things might be going for Matt. And then at the same time, like, you could say that we also might have a sense of where things might be going for Daredevil, but not Matt. Is the Defenders queuing us up for a Danny Rand Daredevil? Like, is that something that's in the mix here? Because we come to find out that the thing that Matt whispers to Danny is, protect my city, which must have gotten a laugh out of you, given what we've been talking about.
Yeah, clearly Matt Murdock is a huge CW's Arrow fan. He's like, this is a great line. I'm going to borrow this one.
I'm going to take that. So he takes that and he delivers it to Danny, and Danny seems to really take it to heart, and he's showing some maturation in these final scenes as well. And his final scene is he is sitting on the edge of a rooftop in Hell's Kitchen and is looking at the Empire State Building that's been lit up red. And, like, are we getting into the territory where Danny Rand is going to assume the Daredevil identity for a little while? Because that's straight out of the comic, too, right?
It is. But, Josh, can I back up for a second? How much of a – I feel like it was such a missed opportunity for him to just whisper, protect my city. I almost wanted him to be like, also, cool tattoo. I'm glad your shirt got ripped so we could finally see it.
You've been working out.
Or he just, right as Danny's running away, he walks right up to him, puts his hand on his shoulder, goes right to his ear, and he says, not Penny's boat.
Oh, my God. Or, yeah, no, I not Penny's boat. We can leave it
there.
Yeah,
but...
Also, an iconic moment involving the hand.
It's perfect. But, no, yeah, I think it's... in the gap between Brian Michael Bendis's Daredevil, where at the end of it, Daredevil has been kind of outed and is, you know, I think in jail maybe. While he is, you know, while Matt Murdock is in prison, there's someone that is masquerading as Daredevil, essentially to clear his name. So people will think that Matt Murdock is not Daredevil, because how could he possibly be? Because Daredevil is running around the city. And I think what we see here is possibly that storyline entering. I mean, when they pan over the shoulder of Finn Jones and he's in shadow on that rooftop, I thought that was going to be like, oh no, Daredevil's still alive, and they're just going to kind of leave it subtle and leave it, you know, up to your imagination of is what's going on. Is that Matt? Is this just a hint that, you know, Daredevil will never die? Who knows? And then they show it's Finn Jones and it's Danny Rand, and I think, yeah, we're definitely probably going to see Finn Jones as Daredevil taking up that mantle, maybe for the first bit of Daredevil's next season, and then by the time we get around to Iron Fist season 2, he's just back to being full-blown Iron Fist. But I did think it was cool. I like he used to wear kind of the kung fu pajamas, I think is what Luke Cage often called him in the comics. But nowadays, Danny Rand sports a kind of a tracksuit, like an Adidas jumpsuit. And I like that appeared to be what he was wearing here, which I thought was cool.
I think it's a cool prospect to consider if they have Danny Rand operating as Daredevil in the next season of Daredevil while Matt is busy doing whatever the heck it is that he's going to be doing. And now you have an opportunity to, like, you know, further the Danny Rand character. Like, please, like, do more of the episode 3 and 4 type of stuff with him, that by the time that you get to Iron Fist season 2, like, you've just, like, now you've done like a little bit more, even more legwork to like get people on board with Danny Rand. Like, I'm open to this. I'm open to this, and it's a cool idea, and it's a fun thing from the comic. So could be fun to see. Jury's out on exactly how it's going to play out. What did you think of the final scene with Jessica and Luke, where they are kind of really just solidifying, like, water under the bridge. You and I are okay. Don't be a stranger. You've got friends here, and you happen to have one that lives in Harlem.
Yeah, we're not having coffee later, though. Wink, wink. Not wink, wink.
Well, they're not going to have coffee while Claire is still in the mix.
Right. No, I think what I liked about both of these scenes, and I love the idea of Iron Fist as Daredevil, partially because I feel like Finn Jones seems to have, as Iron Fist, learned a lot from just playing off of a lot of the other characters on this show. And I think Iron Fist feels much more fleshed out and better because as a character within this universe, he has been exposed to a universe larger than the oddly narrow one they built on his own show. And so I like the idea of more crossovers in these shows. You know, these guys all live in New York. They're all street level heroes. I would hate it if we got four more seasons of these characters barely interacting before we got another Defenders season. That would just feel weird. It doesn't totally make sense. So I like the idea that they're planting some seeds of crossovers of the future.
Well, in terms of final images that we get on the show, and in terms of where the Marvel Netflix universe is going next, we get a really good sense of that with a final teaser at the end of it all. You know, we love these post-credit stingers, Jim. It's a thing. And we get to see the Punisher trailer. We get to see what's coming up when Johnny Bernthal is returning to the Marvel Netflix universe with his own TV show. How amped are you for the Punisher, Jim?
I'm cautiously optimistic. I don't know. We've discussed this a little bit, but I am a little wary of the Punisher as a leading character. I think Daredevil season two, the Punisher as this force of nature, which is, I think, how he works best in the comics. He's not a great leading man so much as he is interesting in the way that he brings things out from other people, or he's interesting in the way that he is the unrelenting hand of, you know, justice, you know, even no matter how violent that justice may be for a criminal. And so I'll be very curious to see what they do with this show, because if it's just about Punisher being kind of a hero, I think it's going to really fall flat. And I think it's going to be 13 episodes too, so...
Yeah, it is.
I think they're going to really have to bring some incredibly compelling villains to this. I think
that 8 to 13 stretch is going to be tough. That's going to be like the 8 to 11 at least is going to be like a slog.
Yeah, I think you're going to need some really compelling villains because, you know, as we were talking about with Foggy and Karen on Daredevil, that show is better because you have a supporting cast and other people on the screen that really, you know, make it watchable. You know, that first season when you had Kingpin in the mix too, like there was a lot going on. And I think that's where Punisher worked really well in Daredevil season two, is because you had Punisher informing Daredevil and Daredevil informing Punisher as characters, you know, Punisher being a killing machine and Matt being someone who is trying to do the right thing. That was a really fun dynamic to see happen. So I think they're going to have to introduce some characters in Punisher that make the Punisher not just a psychopathic murderer, which is often what he is.
It might work if he's not like the singular focus, you know, like if it's done with some dramatic irony, and if it's done like at a little bit of a distance, some of that might work. But I do think that when they do try to take like the outright heroic approach to the Punisher, it typically doesn't land very well. So I think that there has to be something innately anti-heroic in the character. But I mean, the Punisher is a psychopath. So like, I think that like there are ways to lean into that. And we've certainly seen some incredible television shows over the course of, you know, recent television history and just television history generally, where like those kinds of characters who are just like not good people could be very compelling protagonists. But I think that to pretend that that Frank Castle is anything but an extraordinarily damaged murderer would be really denying his fundamental truth. So I hope that that's a big part of the show, and I would just be very curious how they would wield that. If they wield it in a really heroic way, I agree. I think that that's not going to really land. But if they make you uncomfortable by design, I think that there could be something really valuable and cool in that. So I'm excited for it. I think whenever Punisher drops, it's got like a very enigmatic release date. Mm-hmm. You and I will keep an eye out for it, and we'll tackle that whenever it pops up on our radar.
Absolutely. But I think that show is really, maybe more than any of these other shows, going to be make or break by the writing and the supporting cast.
Totally. Yeah, I think that's right. Other than that, that's the Defenders, Jim.
Yeah, I got to say that the only thing that I'm left wondering a little bit with the Defenders is how cleanly the situation was wrapped up. You know, they're kind of like, well, no one's pressing charges. Luke, you're free to go do your stuff. Jessica, you're free to go do your stuff. And at the end of it, I guess we're just left with heroes who are going to become heroes now. And it seems a little odd to go through six seasons now of television just to have our superheroes actively be superheroes. But hey, if that's where we're getting, I'm excited. I feel like these shows have taken a long time to really get to being the superhero shows they were billed as. And so hopefully we can keep the good street level stuff, but also, you know, bring in some of the a little bit crazier, more fun, big action stuff that the Defenders did really well.
Yeah, and I agree with what you said earlier. Like, I hope that we do get to see some of these characters weaving in and out of each other's stories a little bit more. And I mean, that was already something that was baked into Jessica Jones. That's how Luke Cage gets his start in the Marvel Netflix universe. Is he is you know, he's like the co-lead of Jessica Jones. So I imagine that you're not going to see Mike Coulter as a series regular in Jessica Jones anymore now that he has his own show. But it could, you know, pave the way for Kristen Ritter maybe doing like a similar deal where like now she is like a heavily featured person on Luke Cage, or, you know, whatever, however this works out. Or as we're speculating, like you could see Finn Jones doing an arc on Daredevil. That's the kind of thing that I hope that we're going to see more in the second phase of the Marvel Netflix universe. Just a little bit more of this crossover. If we're not going to outright get a Heroes for Hire show, then at least have like Colleen Wing and Danny Rand and Luke Cage and Misty Knight all on Luke Cage together, or even all on Iron Fist together.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe that's even the better answer, is like bring Misty and Luke and Claire all over to Iron Fist. Claire's already there. But bring Luke and Misty there and like have Luke already have his own show, but he can now come and add a little bit of spice to the Iron Fist series. I think that could be really fun. So I don't know. We can dwell on a few more of these possibilities when we get to the feedback show. We can talk a little bit more about where we hope the Marvel Netflix universe goes from here.
That sounds fantastic. But yeah, hopefully they go a little bit that route and make these very, very lengthy 13-episode seasons, break them into smaller arcs. It's worked well in the past, so keep it up.
All right, get your feedback in for us. We're going to record the feedback show in a few days from now. postshowrecaps.com/feedback. That is our feedback form, postshowrecaps.com/feedback. You can tweet at us as well. Jim is at TheJimGibbons. I am at RoundHoward. And we would love to get your feedback. We're very excited to get back into it with just kind of more of a bird's eye view of the Defenders and where the Marvel Netflix universe stands right now. Maybe some further Punisher speculation as well. I'm sure we're going to have a good time talking about everything going on here in the Marvel Netflix universe. But Jim, this was fun talking about the 8 episodes proper in these 4 podcasts. Even if it wasn't always fun on the show itself, I feel like we had a lot of fun, and I think we always had something to talk about. That's really all you can ever ask for. You know, boring podcasting is not what you want.
I mean,
everything. We had a lot of material to sink our teeth into here.
Isn't it, you know, the true goal of art is to inspire conversation, right?
Consider us inspired.
Yeah, so, you know, and honestly, if this show was just plain good, what would we have talked about, Josh? What would we have talked about?
Sunshine, rainbows, unicorns.
Yeah, been 15-minute podcast of just like, well, that was pretty good. I'm going to go make a sandwich. Good talking to you.
I'm sure there are people out there that's like, I would have listened to like the 15-minute positive podcast instead of like an hour and a half of you guys just like shitting all over Finn Jones. I'm sure that there's at least one or three of you out there who are thinking that right now.
I sincerely hope Finn Jones isn't just out there wondering that.
Oh,
he's
God.
Listened to hours of podcasts just going like, come on guys, come on.
It's helping him focus his inner chi.
We just want to bring out his chi, and as we've seen, making him upset brings out his chi better than anything else. So really, we are on the Iron Fist side, just trying to get his chi in check.
We're just trying to get his chi in check. We're just trying to sharpen the Iron Fist here, so don't blame us. Finn, we love you. We believe in your potential. I swear. All right, we will talk about all of that and more in our forthcoming feedback show. Jim, anything else?
No, I think that's it. I'm going to maybe go take some like old rotisserie chicken bones and grind them up into substance and see if that gives me immortality. I'll let you know how it goes on the next podcast.
Yeah, please do. And if it does work out, just like save a little bit for me would be great.
I don't know, Josh. I'm going to keep a lot of this substance to myself. We've seen how much people fight over it.
Yeah. We're not going to get in any arguments over the substance or the stuff right now, but maybe on the feedback show. We'll see you all on the feedback show in just a few days. Take care, everybody. Goodbye.